Ada behind the counter, and I'll think about the cash register. Otherwise, who will take care of the wedding? I don't know for sure if Leela was behind the expulsion of Pinucha and her mother from the daily running of the grocery, behind the hiring of Ada. Certainly Ada was convinced of it, and so especially was Antonio, who began referring to our friend as a good fairy. Of course, she wasn't pleased that her sister-in-law and mother-in-law had a lot of free time to devote to her wedding. The two women complicated life. There were conflicts about every little thing. The guests, the decoration of the church, the photographer, the cake, the wedding favors, the rings, even the honeymoon. Since Pinucha and Maria considered it a poor thing to go to Sorrento, Positano, Ischia, and Capri. So all of a sudden I was drawn in, apparently to give Leela an opinion on this or that, in reality, to support her in a difficult battle. I was starting my third year of high school. I had a lot of new, hard subjects. My usual stubborn diligence was already killing me. I studied relentlessly. But once, coming home from school, I ran into Leela, and she said to me, point blank, "Please, Leenu, tomorrow will you come and give me some advice?" I didn't even know what she meant. I had been tested in chemistry and hadn't done well and was suffering. Advice about what? Advice about my wedding dress. Please don't say no, because if you don't come, I'll murder my sister-in-law and mother-in-law. I went. I joined her, Pinucha, and Maria uneasily. The shop was on the Retifilo, and I remember I had stuck some books in a bag, hoping to find some way of studying. It was impossible. From 4 in the afternoon to 7 in the evening, we looked at styles. We fingered fabrics. Leela tried on the wedding dresses displayed on the shop mannequins. Whatever she put on, her beauty enhanced the dress. The dress enhanced her beauty. Stiff organza, soft satin, airy tulle became her. A lace bodice, puff sleeves became her. A full skirt and a narrow skirt became her. A long train and a short one. A flowing veil and a short one. A crown of rhinestones, of pearls, of orange blossoms. And she, obediently, examined styles or tried on the models that were flattering on the mannequins. But occasionally, when she could no longer bear the fussiness of her future relatives, the old Leela rose up and, looking me straight in the eye, said, alarming mother-in-law, sister-in-law, "What if we chose a beautiful green satin, or a red organza, or a nice black tulle, or, better still, yellow?" It took my laugh to indicate that the bride was joking, to return to serious, rancorous consideration of fabrics and styles. The dressmaker merely kept repeating enthusiastically, "Please, whatever you choose, bring me the wedding pictures so I can display them in the shop window and say, I dressed that girl." The problem, however, was choosing. Every time Leela preferred a style, a fabric, Pinucha and Maria lined up in favor of another style, another fabric. I said nothing, stunned by all those discussions and by the smell of new fabric. Finally, Leela asked me in vexation, "What do you think, Leenu?" There was silence. I suddenly perceived, with a certain astonishment, that the two women had been expecting that moment and feared it. I set in motion a technique I had learned at school, which consisted of this. Whenever I didn't know how to answer a question, I was lavish in setting out premises in the confident voice of someone who knows clearly where he wishes to end up. I said first, in Italian, that I liked very much the styles favored by Pinucha and her mother. I launched not into praise, but into arguments that demonstrated how suitable they were to Leela's figure. At the moment when, as in class with the teachers, I felt I had the admiration, the sympathy of mother and daughter. I chose one of the styles at random, truly at random, careful not to pick one of those that Leela favored, and went on to demonstrate that it incorporated the qualities of the styles favored by the two women, and the qualities of the ones favored by my friend. The dressmaker, Pinucha, the mother, were immediately in agreement with me. Leela merely looked at me with narrowed eyes. Then her gaze returned to normal, and she said that she agreed too. On the way out, both Pinucha and Maria were in a very good mood. They addressed Leela almost with affection, and, commenting on the purchase, kept dragging me in with phrases like, "As Linucha said," or "Linucha rightly said." Leela maneuvered so that we were a little behind them in the evening crowd of the Retifilo. She asked me, "You learn this in school?" "What?" "To use words to con people." I felt wounded. I murmured, "You don't like the style we chose?"
"I like it immensely."
"So?"
"So do me the favor of coming with us whenever I ask you."
I was angry. I said, "You want to use me to con them?" She understood that she had offended me. She squeezed my hand hard. I didn't intend to say something unkind. I meant only that you are good at making yourself liked. The difference between you and me, always, has been that people are afraid of me and not of you.
"Maybe because you're mean," I said, even angrier.
"Maybe," she said. And I saw that I had hurt her and she had hurt me. Then, repenting, I added immediately, to make up, "Antonio would get himself killed for you. He said to thank you for giving his sister a job."
"It's Stefano who gave the job to Ada," she replied. "I'm mean."
53. From then on, I was constantly called on to take part in the most disputed decisions. And sometimes, I discovered, not at Leela's request, but Pinucha and her mother's. I chose the favors. I chose the restaurant in Via Orazio. I chose the photographer, persuading them to include a film in Super 8. In every circumstance, I realized that, while I was deeply interested in everything, as if each of those questions were practice for when my turn came to get married, Leela, at the stations of her wedding, paid little attention. I was surprised, but that was certainly the case. What truly engaged her was to make sure, once and for all, that in her future life as wife and mother, in her house, her sister-in-law and her mother-in-law would have no say. But it wasn't the ordinary conflict between mother-in-law, daughter-in-law, sister-in-law. I had the impression, from the way she used me, from the way she handled Stefano, that she was struggling to find, from inside the cage in which she was enclosed, a way of being, all her own, that was still obscure to her. Naturally, I wasted entire afternoons settling their affairs. I didn't study much, and a couple of times ended up not even going to school. The result was that my report card for the first trimester was not especially brilliant. My new teacher of Latin and Greek, the greatly respected Galliani, had a high opinion of me. But in philosophy, chemistry, and mathematics, I barely passed. Then, one morning, I got into serious trouble. Since the religion teacher was constantly delivering tirades against the communists, against their atheism, I felt impelled to react. I don't really know if by my affection for Pasquale, who had always said he was a communist, or simply because I felt that all the bad things the priest said about communists concerned me directly as the pet of the most prominent communist, Professor Galliani. The fact remains that I, who had successfully completed a theological correspondence course, raised my hand
and said that the human condition was so obviously exposed to the blind fury of chance that to trust in a God, a Jesus, the Holy Spirit, this last a completely superfluous entity, it was there only to make up a trinity, notoriously nobler than the mere binomial father-son, was the same thing as collecting trading cards while the city burns in the fires of hell. Alfonso had immediately realized that I was overdoing it and timidly tugged on my smock. But I paid no attention and went all the way to that concluding comparison. For the first time, I was sent out of the classroom and had a demerit on my class record. Once I was in the hall, I disoriented at first. What had happened? Why had I behaved so recklessly? Where had I gotten the absolute conviction that the things I was saying were right and should be said? And then I remembered that I had had those conversations with Leela, and saw that I had landed myself in trouble because, in spite of everything, I continued to assign her an authority that made me bold enough to challenge the religion teacher. Leela no longer opened a book, no longer went to school, was about to become the wife of a grocer, would probably end up at the cash register in place of Stefano's mother. And I had drawn from her the energy to invent an image that defined religion as the collecting of trading cards while the city burns in the fires of hell? Was it not true, then, that school was my personal wealth, now far from her influence? I wept silently outside the classroom door. But things changed unexpectedly. Nino Saratore appeared at the end of the hall. After the new encounter with his father, I had all the more reason to behave as if he didn't exist. But seeing him in that situation revived me. I quickly dried my tears. He must have realized that something was wrong, and he came toward me. He was more grown up. He had a prominent Adam's apple, features hollowed out by a bluish beard, a firmer gaze. It was impossible to avoid him. I couldn't go back into the class. I couldn't go to the bathroom, either of which would have made my situation more complicated if the religion teacher looked out. So when he joined me and asked why I was outside, what had happened, I told him. He frowned and said, "I'll be right back." He disappeared and reappeared a few minutes later with Professor Galliani. Galliani was full of praise. "But now," she said, as if she were giving me and Nino a lesson, "after the full attack, it's time to mediate." She knocked on the door of the classroom, closed it behind her, and 5 minutes later looked out happily. I could go back, provided I apologized to the professor for the aggressive tone I had used. I apologized, wavering between anxiety about probable reprisals and pride in the support I had received from Nino and from Professor Galliani. I was careful not to say anything to my parents, but I told Antonio everything, and he proudly reported the incident to Pasquale, who ran into Leela one morning, and, so overcome by his love for her that he could barely speak, seized on my adventure like a life vest and told her about it. Thus I became, in the blink of an eye, the heroine both of my old friends and of the small but seasoned group of teachers and students who challenged the lectures of the teacher of religion. Meanwhile, aware that my apologies to the priest were not enough, I made an effort to regain credit with him and with his like-minded colleagues. I easily separated my words from myself. Toward all the teachers who had become hostile to me, I was respectful, helpful, cooperative, so that they went back to thinking of me as a person who came out with odd but forgivable assertions. I thus discovered that I was able to behave like Professor Galliani, present my opinions firmly, and, at the same time, soften them and regain respect, through my irreproachable behavior. Within a few days, it seemed to me that I had returned, along with Nino Saratore, who was in his fifth year and would graduate, to the top of the list of the most promising students in our shabby high school. It didn't end there. A few weeks later, unexpectedly, Nino, with his shadowy look, asked me if I could quickly write half a page recounting the conflict with the priest. To do what with? He told me that he wrote for a little journal called Naples, Home of the Poor. He had described the incident to the editors, and they had said that if I could write an account in time, they would try to put it in the next issue. He showed me the journal. It was a pamphlet of 50 pages, of a dirty gray. In the contents, he appeared, first name and last name, with an article entitled, The Numbers of Poverty. I thought of his father, and the satisfaction, the vanity with which he had read to me at the Maranti, the article he'd published in Roma. Do you also write poetry? I asked. He denied it with such disgusted energy that I immediately promised, All right, I'll try. I went home in great agitation. My head was already churning with the sentences I would write, and on the way I talked about it in great detail to Alfonso. He became anxious for me. He begged me not to write anything. Will they sign it with your name? Yes. Lenu, the priest will get angry again and fail you. He'll get chemistry and mathematics on his side. He transmitted his anxiety to me, and I lost confidence. But as soon as we separated, the idea of being able to show the journal, with my little article, my name in print, to Lila, to my parents, to Maestro Oliviero, to Maestro Ferraro, got the upper hand. I would mend things later. It had been very energizing to win praise from those who seemed to me better, Professor Galliani, Nino, taking sides against those who seemed to me worse, the priest, the chemistry teacher, the mathematics teacher, and yet to behave toward the adversaries in such a way as to not lose their friendship and respect. I would make an effort to repeat this when the article was published. I spent the afternoon writing and rewriting. I found concise, dense sentences. I tried to give my position the maximum theoretical weight by finding difficult words. I wrote, If God is present everywhere, what need does he have to disseminate himself by way of the Holy Spirit? But the half page was soon used up, merely in the premise. And the rest? I started again. And since I had been trained since elementary school to try and stubbornly keep trying, in the end I got a credible result and turned to my lessons for the next day. But half an hour later, my doubts returned. I felt the need for confirmation. Who could I ask to read my text and give an opinion? My mother? My brothers? Antonio? Naturally not. The only one was Lila. But to turn to her meant to continue to recognize in her an authority, when in fact I, by now, knew more than she did. So I resisted. I was afraid that she would dismiss my half-page with a disparaging remark. I was even more afraid that that remark would nevertheless work in my mind, pushing me to extreme thoughts that I would end up transcribing onto my half-page, throwing off its equilibrium. And yet finally I gave in and went to look for her. She was at her parents' house. I told her about Nino's proposal and gave her the notebook. She looked at the page unwillingly, as if the writing wounded her eyes. Exactly like Alfonso, she asked, Will they put your name on it? I nodded, yes. Elena Greco? Yes. She held out the notebook. I'm not capable of telling you if it's good or not. Please. No, I'm not capable. I had to insist. I said, though I knew it wasn't true, that if she didn't like it, if, in fact, she refused to read it, I wouldn't give it to Nino to print. In the end, she read it. It seemed to me that she shrank, as if I had unloaded a weight on her. And I had the impression that she was making a painful effort to free from some corner of herself the old Leela, the one who read, wrote, drew, made plans spontaneously, the naturalness of an instinctive reaction. When she succeeded, everything seemed pleasantly light. Can I erase? Yes. She erased quite a few words and an entire sentence. Can I move something? Yes. She circled a sentence and moved it with a wavy line to the top of the page. Can I recopy it for you onto another page? I'll do it. No, let me do it. It took a while to recopy. When she gave me back the notebook, she said, "You're very clever. Of course they always give you 10. I felt that there was no irony. It was a real compliment. Then she added with sudden harshness, "I don't want to read anything else that you write." Why? She thought about it. Because it hurts me. And she struck her forehead with her hand and burst out laughing. 54. I went home happy. I shut myself in the toilet so that I wouldn't disturb the rest of the family and studied until 3 in the morning, when finally I went to sleep. I dragged myself up at 6:30 to recopy the text. But first, I read it over in Leela's beautiful round handwriting. A handwriting that had remained the same as in elementary school. Very different now from mine, which had become smaller and plainer. On the page was exactly what I had written, but it was clearer, more immediate. The erasures, the transpositions, the small additions, and, in some way, the handwriting itself, gave me the impression that I had escaped from myself, and now was running 100 paces ahead with an energy and also a harmony that the person left behind didn't know she had. I decided to leave the text in Leela's handwriting. I brought it to Nino like that in order to keep the visible trace of her presence in my words. He read it, blinking his long eyelashes. At the end, he said, with sudden, unexpected sadness, "Professor Galliani is right." "About what?" "You write better than I do." And although I protested, embarrassed, he repeated that phrase again, then turned his back and went off without saying goodbye. He didn't even say when the journal would come out or how I could get a copy, nor did I have the courage to ask him. That behavior bothered me, and even more because, as he walked away, I recognized for a few moments his father's gait. This was how our new encounter ended. We got everything wrong again. For days, Nino continued to behave as if writing better than him was a sin that had to be expiated. I became irritated. When suddenly he reassigned me body, life, presence, and asked me to walk a little way with him, I answered coldly that I was busy. My boyfriend was supposed to pick me up. For a while, he must have thought that the boyfriend was Alfonso. But any doubt was resolved when, one day after school, his sister Marisa appeared to tell him something or other. We hadn't seen each other since the days on Ischia. She ran over to me. She greeted me warmly. She said how sorry she was that I hadn't returned to Barano that summer. Since I was with Alfonso, I introduced him. She insisted, as her brother had already left, on going part of the way with us. First, she told us all her sufferings in love. Then, when she realized that Alfonso and I were not boyfriend and girlfriend, she stopped talking to me and began to chat with him in her charming way. She must have told her brother that between Alfonso and me there was nothing, because right away, the next day, he began hovering around me again. But now, The mere sight of him made me nervous. Was he vain like his father, even if he detested him? Did he think that others couldn't help liking him, loving him? Was he so full of himself that he couldn't tolerate good qualities other than his own? I asked Antonio to come and pick me up at school. He obeyed immediately, confused, and at the same time pleased by that request. What surely surprised him most was that there, in public, in front of everyone, I took his hand and entwined my fingers with his. I had always refused to walk like that, either in the neighborhood or outside it, because it made me feel that I was still a child, going for a walk with my father. That day, I did it. I knew that Nino was watching us, and I wanted him to understand who I was. I wrote better than he did. I would publish in the magazine where he published. I was as good at school and better than he was. I had a man. Look at him. And so I would not run after him like a faithful beast. 55. I also asked Antonio to go with me to Leela's wedding, not to leave me alone, and maybe always to dance with me. I dreaded that day. I felt it as a definitive break, and I wanted someone there who would support me. This request was to complicate life further. Leela had sent invitations to everyone. In the houses of the neighborhood, the mothers, the grandmothers, had been working for months to make dresses, to get hats and purses, to shop for a wedding present. I don't know, a set of glasses, of plates, of silverware. It wasn't so much for Leela that they made that effort. It was for Stefano, who was very decent and allowed you to pay at the end of the month. But a wedding was, above all, an occasion where no one should make a bad showing, especially girls without fiancés, who there would have a chance of finding one and getting settled, marrying, in their turn, within a few years. It was really for that last reason that I wanted Antonio to go with me. I had no intention of making the thing official. We were careful to keep our relationship absolutely hidden. But I wished to keep under control my anxiety about being attractive. I wanted that day to feel calm, tranquil, despite my glasses, the modest dress made by my mother, my old shoes, and at the same time think, I have everything a 16-year-old girl should have. I don't need anything or anyone. But Antonio didn't take it like that. He loved me. He considered me the luckiest thing that had ever happened to him. He often asked aloud, with a hint of anguish straining under an appearance of amusement, how in the world I had chosen him, who was stupid and couldn't put two words together. In fact, he couldn't wait to appear at my parents' house and make our relationship official. And so, at that request of mine, he must have thought that I had finally decided to let him come out of hiding, and he went into debt to buy a suit, in addition to what he was spending for the wedding gift, clothes for Ada and the other children, a presentable appearance for Melina. I didn't notice anything. I struggled on, between school, the urgent consultations whenever things got tangled up between Leela and her sister-in-law and mother-in-law, the pleasant nervousness about the article that I might see published at any time. I was secretly convinced that I would truly exist only at the moment when my signature, Elena Greco, appeared in print. And as I waited for that day, I didn't pay much attention to Antonio, who had got the idea of completing his wedding outfit with a pair of Cerullo shoes. Every so often he asked me, "Do you know what point they've reached?" I answered, "Ask Reno. Leela doesn't know anything." It was true. In November, the Cerullos summoned Stefano without bothering to show the shoes to Leela first, even though she was still living at home with them. Instead, Stefano showed up for the occasion with his fiancée and Pinuccia, all three looking as if they had emerged from the television screen. Leela told me that on seeing the shoes she had designed years earlier made real, she had felt a very violent emotion, as if a fairy had appeared and fulfilled a wish. The shoes really were as she had imagined them at the time. Even Pinuccia was amazed. She wanted to try on a pair she liked, and she complimented Reno effusively, letting him understand that she considered him the true craftsman of those masterpieces of sturdy lightness, of dissonant harmony. The only one who seemed displeased was Stefano. He interrupted the warm greetings Leela was giving her father and brother and the workers, silenced the sugary voice of Pinuccia, who was congratulating Reno, raising an ankle to show him her extraordinarily shod foot, and, style after style, he criticized the modifications made to the original designs. He was especially persistent in the comparison between the man's shoe, as it had been made by Reno and Leela in secret from Fernando, and the same shoe as the father and son had refined it. "What's this fringe? What are these stitches? What is this gilded pin?" he asked in annoyance. And no matter how Fernando explained all the modifications, for reasons of durability, or to disguise some defect in the idea, Stefano was adamant. He said he had invested too much money to obtain ordinary shoes, and not, precisely identical, Leela's shoes. The tension was extreme. Leela gently defended her father. She told her fiancé to let it go. Her designs were the fantasies of a child, and surely the modifications were necessary, and besides, were not so great. But Reno supported Stefano, and the discussion went on for a long time. It broke off only when Fernando, utterly worn out, sat down in a corner and, looking at the pictures on the wall, said, "If you want the shoes for Christmas, take them like that. If you want them exactly the way my daughter designed them, have someone else make them." Stefano gave in. Reno, too, gave in. At Christmas, the shoes appeared in the window, a window with the comet star made of cotton wool. I went by to see them. They were elegant objects, carefully finished. Just to look at them gave an impression of wealth that did not accord with the humble shop window, with the desolate landscape outside, with the shop's interior, all pieces of hide and leather and benches and awls and wooden forms and boxes of shoes piled up to the ceiling, waiting for customers. Even with Fernando's modifications, they were the shoes of our childish dreams, not invented for the reality of the neighborhood. In fact, at Christmas, not a single pair sold. Only Antonio appeared, asked Reno for a 44, tried it. Later, he told me the pleasure he had had in feeling so well shod, imagining himself with me at the wedding, in his new suit, with those shoes on his feet. But when he asked the price and Reno told him, he was dumbstruck. "Are you crazy?" And when Reno said, "I'll sell them to you on a monthly installment," he responded, laughing, "Then I'll buy a Lambretta." 56. At the moment, Leela, taken up by the wedding, didn't realize that her brother, until then cheerful, playful, even though he was exhausted by work, was becoming depressed again, sleeping badly, flying into a rage for no reason. "He's like a child," she said to Pinuccia, as if to apologize for some of his outbursts. "His mood changes according to whether his whims are satisfied immediately or not. He doesn't know how to wait." She, like Fernando, did not feel in the least that the failure of the shoes to sell at Christmas was a fiasco. After all, the production of the shoes had not followed any plan. They had originated in Stefano's wish to see Leela's purest caprice made concrete. There were heavy ones, light ones, spanning most of the seasons. And this was an advantage. In the white boxes piled up in the Cerullo's shop was a considerable assortment. They had only to wait, and in winter, in spring, in autumn, the shoes would sell. But Rino was increasingly agitated. After Christmas, on his own initiative, he went to the owner of the dusty shoe store at the end of the Stradone, and, although he knew the man was bound hand and foot to the Solaras, proposed that he display some of the Cerullo shoes, without obligation, just to see how they went. The man said no, politely. That product was not suitable for his customers. Rino took offense, and an exchange of vulgarities followed, which became known in the whole neighborhood. Fernando was furious with his son. Rino insulted him, and Leela again experienced her brother as an element of disorder, a manifestation of the destructive forces that had frightened her. When the four of them went out, she noticed with apprehension that her brother maneuvered to let her and Pinuccia go on ahead, while he stayed behind to talk to Stefano. In general, the grocer listened to him without showing signs of irritation. Only once Leela heard him say, "Excuse me, Rino, do you think I put so much money in the shoe store like that, without any security, just for the love of your sister? We have the shoes. They're beautiful. We have to sell them. The problem is to find the right place." That "just for the love of your sister" didn't please her. But she let it go, because the words had a good effect on Rino, who calmed down and began to talk, in particular to Pinuccia, about strategies for selling the shoes. He said they had to think on a grand scale. Why did so many good initiatives fail? Why had the Goresio auto repair shop given up motorbikes? Why had the dressmaker in the dry goods store lasted only 6 months? Because they were undertakings that lacked breadth. The Cerullo shoes, instead, would as soon as possible leave the local market and become popular in the wealthier neighborhoods. Meanwhile, the date of the wedding approached. Leela hurried to fittings for her wedding dress, gave the final touches to her future home, fought with Pinuccia and Maria, who, among other things, were intolerant of Nunzia's intrusions. The situation was increasingly tense. But the damaging attacks came from elsewhere. There were two events in particular, one after the other, that wounded Leela deeply. One cold afternoon in February, she asked me out of the blue if I could come with her to see Maestra Oliviero. She had never displayed any interest in her, no affection, no gratitude. Now, though, she felt the need to bring her the invitation in person. Since in the past I had never reported to her the hostile tones that the teacher had often used about her, it didn't seem to me right to tell her then, especially since the teacher had recently seemed less aggressive, more melancholy. Maybe she would welcome her kindly. Leela dressed with extreme care. We walked to the building where the teacher lived, near the parish church. As we climbed the stairs, I realized that she was nervous. I was used to that journey, to those stairs. She wasn't, and didn't say a word. I rang the bell. I heard the teacher's dragging steps. "Who is it?" "Greco." She opened the door. Over her shoulders, she wore a purple shawl, and half her face was wrapped in a scarf. Leela smiled and said, "Maestra, do you remember me?" The teacher stared at her as she used to do in school when Leela was annoying. Then she turned to me, speaking with difficulty, as if she had something in her mouth. "Who is it? I don't know her." Leela was confused and said quickly, in Italian, "I'm Cerullo. I've brought you an invitation. I'm getting married, and I would be so happy if you would come to my wedding. The teacher turned to me, said,
I know, Cirullo. I don't know who this girl is.
She closed the door in our faces. We stood without moving on the landing for some moments. Then I touched her hand to comfort her. She withdrew it, stuck the invitation under the door, and started down the stairs. On the street, she began talking about all the bureaucratic problems at the city hall and the parish, and how helpful my father had been. The other sorrow, perhaps more profound, came, surprisingly, from Stefano in the business of the shoes. He had long since decided that the role of speechmaster would be entrusted to a relative of Maria's, who had emigrated to Florence after the war, and had set up a small trade in old things of varied provenance, especially metal objects. This relative had married a Florentine woman, and had taken on the local accent. Because of his cadences, he enjoyed in the family a certain prestige, and also for that reason had been Stefano's confirmation sponsor. But abruptly, the bridegroom changed his mind. At first, Leela spoke as if it were a sign of last-minute nervousness. For her, it was completely indifferent who the speechmaster was. The important thing was to decide. But for several days, Stefano gave her only vague, confused answers, and she couldn't understand who was to replace the Florentine couple. Then, less than a week before the wedding, the truth came out. Stefano told her, as a thing done, without any explanation, that the speechmaster would be Silvio Salata, the father of Marcello and Michele. Leela, who until that moment hadn't considered the possibility that even a distant relative of Marcello Salata might be present at her wedding, became again the girl I knew very well. She insulted Stefano grossly. She said she didn't want to ever see him again. She shut herself up in her parents' house, stopped concerning herself with anything, didn't go to the last fitting of the dress, did absolutely nothing that had to do with the imminent wedding. The procession of relatives began. First came her mother, Nunzia, who spoke to her desperately about the good of the family. Then Fernando arrived, gruff, and told her not to be a child. For anyone who wanted to have a future in the neighborhood, to have Silvio Salata as speechmaster was obligatory. Finally, Reno came, and, in an aggressive tone of voice and with the air of a businessman who is interested only in profit, explained to her how things stood. Salata the father was like a bank, and above all, was the channel by which the Cirullo shoe styles could be placed in shops. "What are you doing?" he shouted at her with puffy, bloodshot eyes. "You want to ruin me and the whole family, and all the work we've done up to now?" Right afterward, even Pinuccia appeared, and said to her, in a somewhat artificial tone of voice, how pleased she too would have been to have the metal merchant from Florence as the speechmaster. But you had to be reasonable. You couldn't cancel a wedding and eradicate a love for a matter of such little importance. A day and a night passed. Nunzia sat mutely in a corner without moving, without caring for the house, without sleeping. Then she slipped out in secret from her daughter and came to summon me, to speak to Leela, to put in a word. I was flattered. I thought for a long time which side to take. There was at stake a wedding, a practical, highly complex thing, crammed with affections and interests. I was frightened. I knew that, although I could argue publicly with the Holy Spirit challenging the authority of the professor of religion, if I were in Leela's place, I would never have the courage to throw it all away. But she, yes, she would be capable of it, even though the wedding was about to be celebrated. What to do? I felt that it would take very little for me to urge her along that path, and that to work for that conclusion would give me great pleasure. Inside, it was what I truly wanted, to bring her back to pale, ponytailed Leela, with the narrowed eyes of a bird of prey in her tattered dress. No more of those airs, not acting like the Jacqueline Kennedy of the neighborhood. But, unfortunately for her and for me, it seemed a small-minded act. Thinking it would be for her good, I would not restore her to the bleakness of the Cirullo house. And so a single idea became fixed in my mind, and all I could do was tell her over and over again, with gentle persuasion, "Silvio Solara, Leela, isn't Marcello, or even Michele. It's wrong to confuse them. You know better than I do. You've said it yourself on other occasions. He's not the one who pulled Ada into the car. He's not the one who shot at us the night of New Year's. He's not the one who forced his way into your house. He's not the one who said vulgar things about you. Silvio will be the speechmaster, and will help Rino and Stefano sell the shoes. That's all. He'll have no importance in your future life." I reshuffled the cards that by now we knew well enough. I spoke of the before and the after, of the old generation and of ours, of how we were different, of how she and Stefano were different. And this last argument made a breach, seduced her. I returned to it passionately. She listened to me in silence. Evidently, she wanted to be helped to compose herself, and slowly she did. But I read in her eyes that that move of Stefano's had shown her something about him that she still couldn't see clearly, and that just for that reason frightened her even more than the ravings of Reno. She said to me, "Maybe it's not true that he loves me." "What do you mean he doesn't love you? He does everything you tell him to." "Only when I don't put real money at risk," she said, in a tone of contempt that I had never heard her use for Stefano Caracci. In any case, she returned to the world. She didn't appear in the grocery. She didn't go to the new house. In other words, she was not the one who would seek to reconcile. She waited for Stefano to say to her, "Thank you. I love you dearly. You know there are things one is obliged to do." Only then did she let him come up behind her and kiss her on the neck. But then she turned suddenly, and looking him straight in the eyes, said to him, "Marcello Solara must absolutely not set foot in my wedding." "How can I prevent it?" "I don't know, but you must swear to me." He snorted and said, smiling, "All right, Leela, I swear." 57. March 12th arrived, a mild day that was almost like spring. Leela wanted me to come early to her old house so that I could help her wash, do her hair, dress. She sent her mother away. We were alone. She sat on the edge of the bed in underpants and bra. Next to her was the wedding dress, which looked like the body of a dead woman. In front of us, on the hexagonal tiled floor, was the copper pot full of boiling water. She asked me abruptly, "Do you think I'm making a mistake?" "How?" "By getting married." "Are you still thinking about the speechmaster?" "No, I'm thinking of the teacher. Why didn't she want me to come in?" "Because she's a mean old lady." She was silent for a while, staring at the water that sparkled in the tub. Then she said, "Whatever happens, you'll go on studying. 2 more years, then I'll get my diploma and I'm done." "No, don't ever stop. I'll give you the money. You should keep studying." I gave a nervous laugh, then said, "Thanks, but at a certain point, school is over. Not for you. You're my brilliant friend. You have to be the best of all, boys and girls." She got up, took off her underpants and bra, said, "Come on, help me. Otherwise I'll be late." I had never seen her naked. I was embarrassed. Today, I can say that it was the embarrassment of gazing with pleasure at her body, of being the non-impartial witness of her 16-year-old's beauty a few hours before Stefano touched her, penetrated her, disfigured her perhaps by making her pregnant. At the time, it was just a tumultuous sensation of necessary awkwardness, a state in which you cannot avert the gaze or take away the hand without recognizing your own turmoil, without, by that retreat, declaring it, hence without coming into conflict with the undisturbed innocence of the one who is the cause of the turmoil, without expressing by that rejection the violent emotion that overwhelms you, so that it forces you to stay, to rest your gaze on the childish shoulders, on the breasts and stiffly cold nipples, on the narrow hips and the tense buttocks, on the black sex, on the long legs, on the tender knees, on the curved ankles, on the elegant feet. And to act as if it's nothing, when instead everything is there, present, in the poor, dim room, amid the worn furniture, on the uneven, water-stained floor. And your heart is agitated, your veins inflamed. I washed her with slow, careful gestures, first letting her squat in the tub, then asking her to stand up. I still have in my ears the sound of the dripping water, and the impression that the copper of the tub had a consistency not different from Leela's flesh, which was smooth, solid, calm. I had a confusion of feelings and thoughts. Embrace her, weep with her, kiss her, pull her hair, laugh, pretend to sexual experience and instruct her in a learned voice, distancing her with words just at the moment of greatest closeness. But in the end, there was only the hostile thought that I was washing her, from her hair to the soles of her feet, early in the morning, just so that Stefano could sully her in the course of the night. I imagined her naked as she was at that moment, entwined with her husband, in the bed in the new house, while the train clattered under their windows and his violent flesh entered her with a sharp blow, like the cork pushed by the palm into the neck of a wine bottle. And it suddenly seemed to me that the only remedy against the pain I was feeling, that I would feel, was to find a corner secluded enough so that Antonio could do to me, at the same time, the exact same thing. I helped her dry off, dress, put on the wedding dress that I thought, with a mixture of pride and suffering, had chosen for her. The fabric became living, over its whiteness ran Leela's heat, the red of her mouth, her hard black eyes. Finally, she put on the shoes that she herself had designed, pressed by Reno, who, if she hadn't worn them, would have felt a kind of betrayal. She had chosen a pair of low heels to avoid seeming too much taller than Stefano. She looked at herself in the mirror, lifting the dress slightly. "They're ugly," she said. "It's not true." She laughed nervously. "But yes, look, the mind's dreams have ended up under the feet." She turned with a sudden expression of fear. "What's going to happen to me, Lenu?" 58. In the kitchen, waiting impatiently for us, were Fernando and Nunzia. I had never seen them so well-dressed and groomed. At that time, Leela's parents, mine, all parents, seemed to me old. I didn't make much of a distinction between them and my grandparents, maternal and paternal, creatures who, in my eyes, all led a sort of cold life, an existence that had nothing in common with mine, with Lila's, Stefano's, Antonio's, Pasquale's. It was we who were truly consumed by the heat of feelings, by the outbursts of thoughts. Only now, as I write, do I realize that Fernando at that time couldn't have been more than 45. Nunzia was certainly a few years younger, and together that morning, he, in a white shirt and dark suit, with his Randolph Scott face, and she, all in blue, with a blue hat and a blue veil, made an impressive sight. The same goes for my parents, about whose age I can be more precise. My father was 39, my mother 35. I looked at them for a long time in the church. I felt with vexation that, that day, my success in school consoled them not at all. That, in fact, they felt, especially my mother, that it was pointless, a waste of time. When Lila, splendid in the dazzling white cloud of her dress and the gauzy veil, processed through the Church of the Holy Family on the arm of the shoemaker and joined Stefano, who looked extremely handsome at the flower-decked altar, lucky the florist who had provided such abundance, my mother, even if her wandering eye seemed to gaze elsewhere, looked at me to make me regret that I was there. In my glasses, far from the center of the scene, while my bad friend had acquired a wealthy husband, economic security for her family, a house of her own, not rented but bought, with a bathtub, a refrigerator, a television, and a telephone. The ceremony was long. The priest drew it out for an eternity. Coming into the church, the relatives and friends of the bridegroom had all sat together on one side, the relatives and friends of the bride on the other. Throughout the ceremony, the photographer kept shooting, flash, spotlights, while his young assistant filmed the important moments. Antonio sat devotedly next to me, in his new tailor-made suit, leaving to Ada, who was really annoyed because as the clerk in the bridegroom's grocery store she might have aspired to a better place, the job of sitting at the back next to Melina and keeping an eye on her, along with the younger children. Once or twice he whispered something in my ear, but I didn't answer. He was supposed simply to sit next to me, without showing a particular intimacy, to avoid gossip. I let my eyes wander through the crowded church. People were bored, and like me, kept looking around. There was an intense fragrance of flowers, a smell of new clothes. Giliola looked pretty, and so did Carmela Peluso. And the boys were their equal. Enzo, and especially Pasquale, seemed to want to demonstrate that there, at the altar, next to Lila, they would have made a better showing than Stefano. As for Reno, while the construction worker and the fruit and vegetable seller stood at the back of the church like sentinels for the success of the ceremony, he, the brother of the bride, breaking the order of family ranks, had gone to sit next to Pinuccia, on the side of the bridegroom's relatives, and he too was perfect in his new suit, cerulean shoes on his feet, as shiny as his brilliantined hair. What a display! It was clear that no one who had received an invitation wanted to miss it, and they came dressed like grand ladies and gentlemen, something that, as far as I knew, as far as everyone knew, meant that not a few, perhaps first of all Antonio, who was sitting next to me, had had to borrow money. Then I looked at Silvio Solara, a large man in a dark suit, standing next to the bridegroom, with a lot of gold glittering on his wrists. I looked at his wife, Manuela, dressed in pink and loaded down with jewels, who stood beside the bride. The money for the display came from them. With Don Achille dead, it was that man, with his purple complexion and blue eyes, bald at the temples, and that lean woman, with a long nose and thin lips, who lent money to the whole neighborhood. Or, to be precise, Manuela managed the practical side. Famous and feared was the ledger book with the red cover in which she put down figures, due dates. Leela's wedding was an affair not only for the florist, not only for the photographer, but, above all, for that couple, who had also provided the cake.